the day, Squivar versus Henderson.
May it please the court, my name is Douglas Grimes.
Mr. Grimes.
I represent the appellate in this case. The issue in this case is whether Ms. Skrvala engaged in statutorily protected activity, whether she was subjected to adverse action, and whether the two were causally connected. It is our position that in this particular case, Ms. Skrvala presented sufficient evidence of retaliation and discrimination under the first prong of the direct method. In this particular case, the trial judge, out of hand, and I believe incorrectly, stated that there was no direct evidence. I think that the court perhaps misconstrued or misunderstood the direct evidence question. In this case, Ms. Skrvala presented evidence under the first prong of the direct evidence method. She presented circumstantial evidence of discrimination as evidenced by the six isolated incidents that the court made reference to at page 31 of its order. Also, the two grievances filed by her alleging harassment and discrimination, and most importantly, the two EEO complaints that she filed in this case. The circumstantial evidence of adverse action in this particular case took the form of the following the filing of the EEOC charges. One was the action in terms of a notice of removal and replacement, and placement on administrative leave without pay, a removal that was reduced to 2 weeks suspension, and a situation where Skrvala was awarded back pay as part of a settlement.
Wasn't that separated, counsel, by a considerable period of time?
I guess one might conclude that there was time between the two. That is true, but our position is that they were all connected. This is a situation that began back in 1996 after Ms. Hoffman came to the Griffith Post Office. And for every year from that point, Ms. Skrvala had to battle a removal notice. And during that period of time, of course, she filed grievances alleging discrimination and harassment. She filed the two EEOC complaints. She filed other grievances. So, yes, but I believe that in this particular case, the court must look at take a longer view of the totality of what occurred in this particular case. In Ms. Skrvala's situation, she had worked for a period of approximately 11 years before she received her first disciplinary action, which was a minor traffic accident. After Ms. Hoffman arrived, that's when everything just took off and she was in a constant battle. So we believe that the court should take a longer view of the facts in this case and not necessarily totally pigeonhole it into a temporal immediacy, if you will. All of this culminated in the notice of removal that actually resulted in Skrvala's termination in June of 2000. The court, taking the position that there was quote unquote no direct evidence, did not consider or place in context the evidence that demonstrated that there was sufficient evidence under the first category of the direct method. It appeared as though the court took the position that there is nothing here, there's no smoking gun, and construed that as the direct method. And our position is that we did present evidence under the first prong of the direct method.
What would that smoking gun be?
Well, there would not have been a smoking gun, and that's why we're not suggesting that there was, and we believe that the court did take the position that there was no smoking gun under its construction of direct evidence, which rarely is.
It is your position, though, that there is direct evidence?
I'm sorry?
It's your position that there is direct evidence?
Under the first prong of the direct method, yes.
And what would that be?
That would be the situations where she filed grievances, where she filed the EEOC complaints. Those would be bits and pieces of evidence that would go to the issue of intentional discrimination under the first prong of the direct approach. So we believe that we have met that requirement. We have presented sufficient evidence of that in this particular case. The termination, her termination, the attempts at removal that failed, these are all bits and pieces we believe that show or from which a jury could infer that there was intentional discrimination over the years of the activity in this particular case. With regard to the issue of pretext, I would like to posit with the court, although I'm well aware of the precedents, I believe that pretext is fact-laden. And so when the trial court says that there is no evidence of pretext, then that, in my view, in most cases, demonstrates a weighing of the evidence in that particular instance. The whole issue of honesty, who determines honesty? It seems to me that that's a credibility determination that is not the function of the trial court on summary judgment. But we see it all the time. And honesty is the issue. How do you determine honesty based on paper? I believe that we can only determine pretext that is founded on honesty by a fact finder being able to look at a witness in the eye, listen to the inflection in their voice, looking at their body language, and determining a fact.
Is there any support for that proposition that pretext cannot be determined on summary judgment against the claimant?
Not in this circuit. There clearly isn't. And what I'm suggesting is I think that's wrong. How can you determine honesty based upon a piece of paper? I don't care how many pieces of paper you have. It seems to me that inherent in that are issues of credibility that someone has to weigh and determine. And I don't think you could do that on a piece of paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grimes. Ms. Davila?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good morning, Judge Bauer, Judge Flom, Judge Sykes. My name is Carol Davila, and I represent the defendant postmaster in this appeal. There are three issues I would like to discuss this morning. The first is whether plaintiff preserved her discrimination claims in this appeal. The second is whether plaintiff's union grievances and disagreements with her supervisors constitute activity protected by Title VII. And the third one is whether plaintiff identified any similarly situated employee with regard to her claim that retaliation motivated her removal from the Postal Service. For the first issue, whether plaintiff preserved her discrimination claims in this appeal, defendant asserts that the answer is no. The court below specifically found that this plaintiff abandoned her age and gender-based discrimination claims when she failed to even mention them in her opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment. Plaintiff's district court submission shows that when confronted with defendant's motion for summary judgment, plaintiff failed to present any argument regarding the discrimination claims. That silence rightfully led the district court to find that plaintiff effectively admitted that there are no disputed issues of fact which warrant a trial on her age and her gender discrimination claims. In her reply brief in this appeal, plaintiff argues for the first time that she did respond to and opposed defendant's summary judgment on her discrimination claims. But this court has consistently held that arguments raised for the first time in a reply brief come too late and will not be considered. Thus, defendant contends that she did waive her discrimination claims in this appeal. The second issue is whether the various disagreements and grievances enumerated by the plaintiff over a period of time constitute activity protected by Title VII. Obviously, defendant feels that they do not constitute such protected activity. The plaintiff's examples of what she calls protected activity include union grievances where she grieved about putting a route up for bid, or to get a route inspection, or to grieve what she considered an overburdened route to get the route changed. Those and similar requests, which cover a long period of time, in fact from 1993, which is 3 years prior to when Supervisor Hoffman even came to the Griffith Post Office and became her supervisor. Those are the things that were listed by this plaintiff as arguments both for adverse actions and as a basis for pretext. The district court held correctly that all but one of the activities that plaintiffs listed were either matters of labor management relations or matters covered by the collective bargaining agreement between the Postal Service and plaintiff's union. Those activities are outside of the ambit of activities protected by Title VII. I would like to mention as an aside that counsel said that there were two grievances where plaintiffs alleged harassment. Those grievances are not in the record. Plaintiff is not entitled in this court to present a Title VII claim that her supervisors at the Griffith Post Office sought to terminate her because of union grievances, when, as here, those grievances do not involve allegations of discriminatory treatment. The third issue I'd like to discuss is, did plaintiff identify a similarly situated employee with regard to her retaliation claim? Plaintiff claims she did. Plaintiff argues that she established a prima facie case of retaliation because she was not treated the same as a similarly situated employee. That claim is without merit. Plaintiff's only comparative employee is an unnamed carrier who received a letter of warning from Supervisor Hoffman for unnecessarily filling out an overtime form. That one act does not make the two employees similarly situated. For one thing, plaintiff failed to show that that employee who received a lesser discipline had a disciplinary history similar to hers. The Postal Service uses a progressive system of discipline, starting out with a letter of warning, and if that doesn't work, it's like we all deal with our children, we get a little harder, maybe a 7-day suspension, going up to a 14-day suspension, and ultimately a termination. In this case, the plaintiff had two letters of warning, a 7-day suspension, and two 14-day suspensions prior to the time on May 25th, 2000, when the actions occurred that led to her removal. The record in this case shows that there is an absence of the requisite similarity between plaintiff's behavior that caused her termination. The unnecessarily filling out an overtime form was only one of many, many incidents that happened on May 25th that led her supervisor to request her removal. And there's a difference in the disciplinary history, at least we think there is, because there is no evidence in the record that the other employee had anything other than a letter of warning. In this case, plaintiff failed to establish a prima facie case that her removal from the Postal Service was the result of either discriminatory or retaliatory treatment by her supervisors. The defendant respectfully requests that the court affirm the district court decision granting summary judgment in favor of the defendant. If there are no questions.
Thank you, Ms. DeVelo. Mr. Grimes.
With all due respect to my friend, Mr. DeVelo, we did raise the issues of discrimination, and it wasn't the first time on appeal. If you look at our reply brief, we set out.
You're not raising it for the first time in the reply brief.
Oh, no. In the reply brief, we were replying to that contention that we had waived it.
All right.
And we set out there, clearly, all of the areas in our papers where we did direct the court to instances that we believe the facts demonstrate were discriminatory.
Which were those, Mr. Brown?
I'm sorry?
Could you just briefly...
Yes. What we did was we talked about at page one of the reply brief that this, where Scarala was discriminated against based on gender pertaining to her attempts to take her afternoon 10-minute break in the GPO, as did mail carriers Wally Herrera, Jerry Schaefer, Bill Stamos, and Warren Taylor. And they took that time in the post office. When Ms. Scarala attempted to do that, then she was reprimanded. There was discriminatory discipline of plaintiff based on sex for failing to complete 18 delivery stops because to do so required unauthorized overtime. In that situation, you are supposed to ask for overtime before you leave, and no one else but my client did it in the GPO. And so when she, after having been chastised for not asking for approval of overtime previously, on this occasion, she said, I'm not going to expose myself to that again. And so she came in, even though these stops were yet to be made, because she had been threatened by Hoffman the first time that she did it, she would be disciplined for that. We also talked about similarly situated mail carrier under Hoffman's supervision was treated more favorably than Scarala. I want to address that in terms of the 3999.
You're going to have a kind of a problem because your red light's on.
Oh, I'm sorry, Judge. I thought I had 3 minutes. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grimes. The case is taken under advisement.